Lee Reynolds. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an on-the-ground perspective of how longtime residents of a small Appalachian town face a wave of out-of-state white Christian nationalist developers. We'll talk with local resident Kimberly Silvestri. She's a homeowner in Gainesboro, Tennessee, about how her town is reacting to this alarming development. We'll then be joined by international law expert Professor Marjorie Cohen, who will discuss the recent controversy over six members of Congress issuing a public statement reminding military members of their right and duty to disobey unlawful order. Professor Cohen will also discuss the troubling resolution by the UN Security Council endorsing a plan by Donald Trump to take control over Gaza through a U.S.-led Board of Peace.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
A quiet rural county in Tennessee has become an unexpected front line in a national struggle over identity, democracy, and belonging. Jackson County, a small Appalachian community of rolling hills, family farms, and a slowly revitalizing town center, is now embroiled in a political and ideological clash. Longtime residents are facing a wave of out-of-state white Christian nationalist developers. Their stated goals include rolling back civil rights gains, discouraging women from higher education or voting, and expelling immigrants who are already U.S. citizens. At the heart of the effort are developers Ridge Runner and New Founding. They're buying up hundreds of acres to create an ideological enclave, and they're consolidating local political power. Ridge Runner CEO Josh Abatov has sold land to two podcasters, Andrew Isker and CJ Engel. These so-called ambassadors state publicly that they want to attract hundreds or thousands of people to Jackson County who share their Christian nationalist vision. Locals fear the county is being used as a pilot for a broader national strategy, intentional migration to reshape rural America and take over local governments. In a place where county elections are often decided by fewer than 300 votes, this danger is not theoretical. A disciplined ideological bloc of just a few hundred people could rewrite policy, alter governance, and silence dissent. Today we're joined by Kimberly Silvestri, a homeowner in Gainesboro. She's a former professional pilot with a background in science and is getting her master's degree. She'll talk about how this movement is unfolding on the ground. Kimberly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start, if you could please paint a picture for our listeners of daily life in Jackson County. Do neighbors know one another, for instance? And what is the character of the local community?
Oh my goodness, this slice of Middle Tennessee is special. When I arrived in 2019, I thought I was just going to be spending a few months living here temporarily, but I quickly fell in love with the kindness and the welcoming nature of this community and the quaint personalities of the historic buildings. So much of it is amazing, and I love being a part of it. Seriously, compared to the Florida cities I lived in growing up, daily life in Jackson County is really like stepping into the past to a simpler time where people don't rush each other, road rage isn't a thing. There's still cash-only shops around here that have just always been like that. In the small city of Gainesboro, where I live, we only have a population of about 1,000 people, so we're just kind of all on the same team, and it isn't a huge team. But crime is extremely minimal, way below the national average. Gainesboro was established in the early 1800s, so many families here go back generations, never leaving. And you can't really get away with treating others poorly out here because everyone would hear about it. It just doesn't happen. Unlike other populated cities that I've lived in, I am close to my neighbors here. And even though there's more literal distance between our homes than neighbors I had in, you know, Florida's suburbia, on my street here, we borrow random groceries from each other. Our kids are best friends. We help each other with farm work and mending fences when, like, the goats get out. And we spend some holidays together. One family even makes sure my livestock has enough hay for the winter, and I give theirs access to my pastures throughout the year, too. So I think that's one of the most defining characteristics of this community, that we all just always look out for each other. And in all my years here, no one has ever asked me about which political party I belong to, what my religious beliefs are, what my education level was, the football team I cheer for. We just don't do that dividing up tribalism stuff out here.
Well, having lived there several years, when did you first notice something bigger was happening with these wealthy developers?
I'd say it was a little over a year ago. I started hearing murmuring around the town about a developing company and its business partners buying up hundreds of undeveloped acres right next to our local middle school and high school. And now Jackson County has seen a lot of steady growth, and it's been thoughtful over the last decade, so that wasn't a problem. And I can obviously relate to the idea of wanting to relocate here after living in big cities elsewhere. So we didn't think much of it at first, or at least I didn't. Then maybe a few weeks later, I was spending time with friends that are those multi-generational locals I mentioned, and the topic of all that land and the new developers came up. And I learned then that others had wanted to build on that land in the past over the years, but according to people that have apparently had it tested in the past, that land don't perk. Do you know what that means?
No.
I didn't know either, because I wasn't originally from a rural area. Turns out it means that the land has failed percolation tests over the years, and that means it doesn't drain well enough to set up septic systems out there. So it sounds like whoever they were buying up this land, they didn't do their research very well before deciding to buy it for housing developments, unless their plan was always outhouses. I don't know. It wasn't until I started noticing coordinated antagonistic posts on our local Facebook community groups a few months later that I began actually growing concerned, because it seemed strategic. There was like disagreements on there that started becoming more argumentative, political, religious in these online spaces. And it just kept leading back to the Ridge Runner guys. And through conversations, meetings, and research with other concerned friends and allies in the community, we learned that three of them are the main players that are setting up the infrastructure here in our community. And these are the ones that are apparently planning on enticing hundreds here. There's Ingle, Isker, and Abatoy. And so once we started looking into them a little more, just on their everything that was posted online, they put up podcasts. They have a significant online presence. And on there, they openly praise and promote the ideologies of white Christian nationalism. And their online realm, it's so much more overt than they are in person. Like, Isker flat out refers to himself as a Christian nationalist often. He pretty much wears it like a badge online. And then the other two seem to openly agree with all of those oppressive, racist, sexist ideologies, but they seem to prefer to distance themselves from that particular Christian nationalist label. Bad press, I guess. I don't know. But they state their intentions openly and their plans for Jackson County really candidly there as well. They talk about how this wasn't the only place that they bought property recently. They bought up a chunk in Kentucky too, but as far as I know, they haven't done much with that yet. They say that they've decided their first couple of developments would be in my town of Gainsboro instead, and they're also trying in the nearby county, our next door county, Salina, Clay County as well, just one county over. So it's a doozy. They author books about Christian nationalism, create podcasts, online publications. Each of them have public X accounts, formerly Twitter, that they're very active on. They do a lot of promoting their bigotry on each other's podcasts. And so that's how I came to realize they were Christian nationalists. There are so many examples of them with their own words insisting that the civil rights movement was America's biggest mistake, demanding that white Christian men take back their rightful power, arguing that women shouldn't be permitted to have an education or vote in anything. They promote oppression, particularly as it pertains to women and people of color. So everything that I've seen about their online promotion, it seems like a hate group. And they won't call themselves that because it's also, there's a real estate business tied to it, but that's the reason it's making national headlines, because it appears that these guys actually do have the financial backing, at least, to start their small rural town takeover plan here. And they've said on their podcasts and in their books that if it's successful here in Gainsboro, they tend they intend to replicate that same operating procedure around the country. So they discuss their intentions to concentrate their numbers in cities and towns that are county seats for the purpose of influencing our legislation decisions in their favor. And that maths out because Gainesboro is the county seat for Jackson County. And, oh, remember they also just recently bought land in Salina, Tennessee? That just so happens to be the county seat of Clay County next door. So they are stating that they want to build aligned communities, bringing in a wave of their people, like-minded followers, all migrating together to strategic rural areas, places like here, where an influx of a few hundred votes could really impact our elections drastically.
Wow. What a contrast to the community life you so beautifully described.
And exactly.
Makes me want to move down there. So you've actually answered my next question, which was that supporters claim the development is simply about revitalization and housing. From what you've described, everything they post on social media makes a strong case that this is an ideological movement rather than coming to give an economic benefit to the community.
Yes, they state in their own public podcast that they intend to plant a flag and that they want to build up the town, reshaping it into their vision of utopia. So I think it's pretty straightforward. They say we're white Christian men should have all the positions of power and women should stay home without an education or an opportunity to vote. They post these kinds of things on their public accounts. They've recorded their own out loud discussions, which when I watch them, I'm like, I can't believe they're saying these things out loud. But they say them and then they post them. Things about if they had it their way, some people of color might be able to stay in their ideal town, but only if they agree not to mention that old slavery stuff anymore and that everyone else that wasn't born here should be deported. They state in their own public podcast that they intend to plant a flag and that they want to build up the town, reshaping it into their vision of utopia, where white Christian men have all the power and their women stay at home without an education or the opportunity to vote. They've recorded these out loud discussions, which are surprising that they're saying it out loud and then afterwards choosing to post it, but they do. And they discuss if they had things their way, some people of color might be able to stay in this ideal town, but only if they agree not to mention that old slavery stuff anymore. And they say everyone else not born here should be deported. They discuss these logistics candidly when they think they're preaching to like-minded individuals and theobros on their online venues. They literally make the daily decision to post this stuff intentionally. And they also put out plenty of content that attempts to paint them in a more palatable light, too. These guys know when they're being figured out. They do a quick pivot, and then they adjust their verbiage to sound more like reasonable, moderate people as needed. I've noticed their messaging shift depending on who they think is listening. So, no, I don't trust that this is primarily about revitalization. That's just one of the masks they wear sometimes, it seems. The resistance they're facing here has never been about locals or liberals wanting to prevent housing growth or to throw a wrench in restoration efforts around here. In fact, over the last several years, there have been incredible positive developments, totally separate from these guys locally. Gainesboro is being steadily revitalized and enriched by new businesses on and around our historic town center. And we're psyched about all of those growths and renovations. New restaurants have opened this year, like the Boardroom Steakhouse. And just a few months ago, we got our first modern art museum. It's called Gaines Mod. And we have Art Mart now, which provides free art classes. So yes, we're very cultured now. We have Gainesboro Gardens is also brand new. They sell rare and interesting plant varieties and host free plant swap events for people that want to trade. We have a community center in the works, a hotel that's being renovated. That's the kind of movement we'd prefer Gainesboro getting this kind of attention for. But unfortunately, we meet like this instead.
Well, as you're explaining, Ridge Runner and New Founding has attracted leaders and podcasters who openly embrace Christian nationalism. You've given us a clear picture of how you have reacted to this, but how has that messaging landed generally in the community and among friends and neighbors? Are people afraid? Do they express their feelings in that regard?
Yes, their activity in Jackson County is making many local folks uneasy. But the community that was already here before this will always be defiant of an ideology that seeks to divide us, because working together and being on the same team is something we already had pretty much well figured out before they got here. So looking out for each other was kind of our thing. No group of extremists is going to change that. And I think they obviously didn't do enough research before choosing Gainesboro to plant their flag.
I understand, and I really appreciate what you said earlier about neighbors not asking about political views or religion, but is it accurate that Jackson County is already leaning conservative? And then I would ask, how is this current movement different from traditional Republican or Christian values already existing in the region?
Yes, based on how this area typically votes, I'm sure our demographics on paper were most of the reason why they chose this little rural town. Admittedly, we are predominantly white, predominantly conservative, predominantly Christian. Land is inexpensive out here. Most of the population of Gainesboro has silver hair and are not particularly tech savvy. So I get why they thought we'd be values aligned and just roll over to get built on top of when they showed us their deep pockets. But they didn't take time to learn about the heart and resilience of our people here before they invested in this plan of steamrolling us. We aren't the rolling over types. We, especially when it comes to racism, sexism, oppression of others, using religion as a weapon for control. That's not the kind of Christians and the kinds of conservatives we have here.
Well, Josh Abatoy, the CEO of Ridge Runner, has said that no one is being excluded, and that the critics are overreacting to media narratives. How do you respond to that?
They're trained professionals when it comes to bending their messaging for their needs and their audience. Abatoy is a private equity lawyer and a venture capitalist, and he's their main PR guy. And he's well-versed in wordplay and misdirection. I've seen where he sometimes tries to distance himself from Engel and Isker by making statements like, they're just customers that he sold land to. But that's just more calculated deception on his behalf, I believe, because he wants to avoid being directly linked to the more controversial and hateful things they say publicly on their podcasts. And again, he's got some money on the line with these land purchases and housing developments being built. So the three of them are guests on each other's podcasts, speakers at each other's events, and clearly working together to attract and consolidate an influx of aligned followers to relocate here. So I'm not interested in responding to his latest deceptive phrasing. It doesn't really matter. They say a lot of things to make all of this seem benign, but you touched on an interesting point there regarding the disconnect between media narratives, like what's been going on in their digital landscape and bleak worldview, preaching controversial content to their online followers versus what our reality is actually like here on the ground level in real life. These white Christian nationalists are online daily blaming America's problems on the 19th Amendment and the fact that anyone other than white men ever obtained voting rights. And there, in that non-reality, they're buoyed and supported by other extremists that they've connected to on the internet, but they've accumulated this significant online following that has probably made them feel justified in fighting for social division and such, but their disdain for everyone looks totally different than how we operate here. On there, they are able to find people that want male heritage American supremacy like they do. And I'm sure they feel plenty validated in that digital space. But the only problem is we're an analog town, probably the most analog town you'll ever find. We meet people face to face. We don't care about hot takes on Twitter. They're trading in cryptocurrency. Well, like I said, we still have some shops that don't even take credit cards yet. They just cash only. We can't relate to all of that nonsense going on with them. Our calmer way of life here is intentional. So yeah, the disconnect feels significant, and they don't want to know us or understand us, and they haven't tried to. What they're about couldn't be more opposite of the way we live here in Gainesboro.
I want to hear a little more about their ideology, their restrictive views on gender roles and education. Because I understand that there are many women-owned businesses in the area. Are you seeing any specific comments or examples of how they might treat women, and especially educated women?
Yes. I have come across some of their content in that regard. Discussing how they detest college-educated white women or something to that regard was posted. They said on a podcast that they don't want to see women within the public sector at all, and often post commentary about the 19th Amendment and civil rights movement having ruined the country. That was precisely what I meant by it couldn't be more opposite of how we live, because those restrictive gender roles don't align with our values that we've already had here for decades. Like, Gainsborough is proud and supportive of our strong female leaders and our business owners. Every function of professional level is women are in as well, from our law enforcement officers to government positions, even our judge. Like, we all have equal rights around here, and that is also intentional.
Well, I understand that these leaders held election night watch parties and encouraged supporters to flood local institutions. Were there attempts to take over the local Republican Party?
I wasn't there, so I don't know much about that, but I did hear about it, because everybody talks about everything that happens in this town. There's only 1,000 of us. But from what I understand, they created a new profile on X for an election night watch party last year, and they apparently named it the official account of the Jackson County GOP, and then live streamed for hours representing themselves in that capacity. And at some point, the actual Jackson County Republican Party chair caught wind of that and apparently told them to delete the account. I have no idea if things went sideways after that, but yeah, that's another example of them not doing their research and just trying to steamroll over the community that already exists here. They're meeting resistance, though.
The Dairy Queen incident became a moment that people still talk about. Can you walk us through what happened and why it mattered?
Yes, that's another one I wasn't physically there for, but I think it was January of this past year, I do remember seeing their targeted cyberbullying and organized character attacks that stemmed from that event, which seemed to inflame relations well beyond whatever conversations or disagreements occurred in person there at Dairy Queen. From what I gathered, it was a peaceful community action. Local residents apparently found out that some of the white Christian nationalist guys were having weekly meetings, sharing their ideologies at the local Dairy Queen's lobby. And we didn't know anything about them back in January, except that they had bought a bunch of land, had hateful personas online, and they wanted to build a housing development. They were otherwise pretty enigmatic back then. So from what I heard, many residents of Jackson County arrived at the Dairy Queen that morning before their standard meeting started, presumably to fill the rest of the lobby and perhaps talk to these guys in person, together in public for safety, I imagine. Like I said, I wasn't there. But it seemed to me that it was a peaceful demonstration of our town's unity. And for them, it was definitely an opportunity for these guys to really integrate themselves into our community, if that was indeed ever their goal. It was a perfect time to introduce themselves and tell Gainsborough what they're about, to discuss their plans and reassure the people that are already living here that they don't intend to do any of the heinous things that it sounds like they want to do. That isn't what they did, though. I heard it was all non-aggressive and fine in person at the Dairy Queen. Everyone went their separate ways unharmed afterwards. But once these guys got home, they cranked up the heated accusations on their computers and their phones online. And they seemed to enjoy stirring up the drama mill on social media. They engaged in bullying one of our local mayoral candidates because of that incident. And he was a true champion of what actually represents Gainsborough and our values and what we believe in. He was a local veteran that everyone respected and appreciated. He's been giving back to Gainsborough his whole life. And unfortunately, one of the outcomes from that DQ incident was that that candidate ended up dropping out of the race just to avoid further targeting and slandering by this group of new guys. So that's when I first realized that they were bullies and intentionally trying to sow discord and cause problems in our community. I think it's all strategy.
Well, it's good to hear about folks organizing and resisting, like the Dairy Queen incident. Tell us more broadly how local residents are responding, how they're organizing, either formally or informally and collaboratively, to respond to all this.
Local residents have been pushing back against their discriminative messaging in a variety of ways. Some have put up signs around town in their lawns, nice signs that say things like, hate has no home in Gainsboro, or welcome, you belong here, posters like that with sunflowers on them, just like to mitigate any misunderstandings that only certain types of people are supposed to be here and that everybody belongs here. Some residents have put up welcoming billboards that are contrary to the Christian nationalist exclusionary rhetoric too. Groups of community members and friends have joined together in meetings to learn facts about what is happening with this in Tennessee, and also to develop a better understanding of this issue on a national scale, because we realized that this isn't the only place this is happening. Many of us have become reluctant spokespeople on behalf of the existing community. We didn't sign up for this, but we do have to protect ourselves and the reputation of this special place that we call home, and being vocal in opposition to white nationalism feels like an important response. When you stand up for equality, other people often feel brave enough to come forward as well. So that's my hopes in putting myself out there a little more vocally. Plus, I have two sons to raise here, and I don't want that oppressive white supremacy nonsense to be normalized at any point where it could influence their healthy psychosocial development. So it's been really reassuring to witness the town coming together on this. Surprisingly, it has actually deepened our community bonds. These pressures have made it clear what we stand to lose, and we collectively decided that we're not willing to lose it. So as a result, many of us are closer knit now than we even were a year ago.
In our remaining minutes, Kimberly, what do you see as the long-term risks of developments like this, not just for Jackson County, but for rural America more broadly?
I think there are many battles that take place across America on any given day. Gainsboro is unfortunately at the front lines of this one. A lot of efforts that we're making today is in hopes that we'll never have to find out what the worst case long-term outcomes are. What I do know is that Gainsboro is expanding and growing and so full of heart, and these guys want to mold us into something else, something closed off and harsh, a place where everybody looks the same and believes the same, and they want to replicate that in other areas of the country too if it works here. But where's the America in that? It makes me feel hopeful when I see so many brave, proud, and awesome women and allies in my community. They keep me motivated. This town gives me so much hope because everybody that lives here cares so much about it. And we don't want to lose that sense of belonging, that trust that we're always going to be looking out for each other in this town. It's worth preserving, and we're here for it.
Kimberly, how can listeners follow this story or support your community response?
Come visit us in Jackson County, of course, Tennessee. Come visit and experience our kindness and our inclusion firsthand. We have a wonderful downtown area with shops and dining options. Like I said, many of them are women-owned. We have stunning hikes to waterfalls, and there's even a place in Granville that does guided trail rides on horseback. I could go on and on of what makes this place so special, but you really just do have to come here and experience it yourself. And I hope you all do.
Count me in.
Yes.
Kimberly, it's been really a pleasure to talk to you firsthand about what's happening on the ground. And we'd love to stay in touch and hear more about future developments.
Thank you for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The extent to which Donald Trump is willing to go to dismantle the rule of law at home and abroad is breathtaking and dangerous. In some cases, leaders are pushing back, but in other cases, major institutions are enabling Trump's lawlessness. To discuss examples of both, we're very pleased to be joined by Marjorie Cohn. She's Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and past President of the National Lawyers Guild. She sits on the National Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace, and she's co-author with Kathleen Gilbert of Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. She's been called to testify at military courts-martial about the legal duty to disobey unlawful orders, and she writes a regular column for Truth Out. And let's not forget, she's a former co-host of this show, Law and Disorder. In a recent 90-second video organized by Senator Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, two senators and four Congress members, all U.S. military or CIA veterans, took turns reading a statement addressed to active service members, urging them to refuse to follow illegal orders. Quote, like us, you all swore an oath to protect and defend this Constitution, the lawmakers said. Quote, our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders. No one has to carry out orders that violate the law or our Constitution. Immediately on Truth Social, Trump responded, quote, it's called seditious behavior at the highest level. That was in all caps. Each one of these traitors to our country should be arrested and put on trial. In subsequent posts, Trump wrote, lock them up, seditious behavior, punishable by death. Trump also reposted a statement saying, hang them, George Washington would. Now the Department of War is investigating one of the senators, Mark Kelly, for, quote, serious allegations of misconduct, threatening to call him back to active duty and court-martial him. Meanwhile, on November 17, 2025, the UN Security Council enshrined Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian lands, put its imprimatur on Israel's genocide, and granted colonial control over the lives of the Palestinians to the United States, which has aided and abetted the genocide. The Council adopted Resolution 2803 by a vote of 13-0. Russia and China, both permanent members of the Security Council, could have vetoed it, but they abstained. The resolution incorporates Donald Trump's, quote, peace plan. It grants control over Gaza to the U.S.-led Board of Peace, and it orders the deployment of a U.S.-led occupation force called the International Stabilization Force, the ISF. Trump will oversee both colonial bodies in collaboration with Israel. Palestinians will not be allowed to participate in their own governments. Marjorie Cohn has written revealing articles for Truth Out about both of these alarming situations. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Well, let's start with that video from the members of the Senate and Congress. Please explain to our listeners, were they right? Do members of the U.S. military have the right to refuse to follow illegal orders?
They were absolutely correct, Steve. And not only do service members have the right to refuse illegal orders, they have a duty to refuse illegal orders. The Uniform Code of Military Justice provides that a service member can be punished by court-martial for refusing a lawful order. Now, it doesn't define lawful, but the manual for courts-martial, which has the force of law, says that an order is lawful unless contrary to the Constitution, the laws of the United States, or lawful superior orders, or for some other reason is beyond the authority of the official issuing it. Now, although it may be inferred that an order to perform a military duty or act is lawful, that inference does not apply to a patently illegal order, such as one that directs the commission of a crime. Acting pursuant to orders is a legitimate defense unless the accused knew the orders were unlawful, or a person of ordinary sense and understanding would have known the orders to be unlawful. Finally, the lawfulness of an order is a question of law to be determined by a military judge at a court-martial or at a war crimes tribunal. Normally, that determination can only be made after a service member refuses or disobeys an order. So the refuser takes the risk that a judge will find the order to be lawful and he or she will be punished for refusing to follow it.
Marjorie, give us some general examples of unlawful orders over time that members of the military acting inside or outside of the United States have the duty to refuse to follow.
Well, a couple of examples inside the United States. One is the use of military forces to deport, remove, or detain immigrants. The Convention Against Torture forbids the removal of someone to a country where there's a substantial likelihood of torture. The U.S. has ratified the Convention of Torture, making it part of the U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. A second example of unlawful orders within the U.S. is the use of military forces against civilian protesters. The Posse Comitatus Act forbids the use of federal troops to enforce domestic law unless there is a, quote, insurrection, unquote. Now, some examples of unlawful orders outside the United States include military attacks on vessels in international or foreign waters. And I know we're going to be talking more about this. An invasion or attack on, say, Venezuela, Mexico, Nigeria. The use of preemptive military force against Iran or China or another country. The use of nuclear weapons against any country. The torture or cruel treatment of civilians, prisoners of war, or other detainees. The intentional targeting of civilians and, for example, attacking Palestinians in Gaza under the guise of so-called peacekeeping.
Let's talk about some precedents across the spectrum that you are discussing. In 1968, U.S. Army Lieutenant William Calley led 100 U.S. troops into the village of My Lai in Vietnam and killed 500 civilian women, children, and elderly men in what came to be known as the My Lai Massacre. Lieutenant Calley argued that he was just following superior orders. Was that defense upheld? What happened to Lieutenant Calley?
Well, first let me say that charges were filed against 25 people, including generals. They were all dismissed or acquitted, except for Calley. Now, at his court-martial, he said he was following Commander Captain Ernest Medina's orders to kill all the villagers because everyone in the village was the enemy. Now, like the Nazi officials did at Nuremberg, Calley's defense, as you said, was that he was just following superior orders. But like the Nuremberg tribunal, that defense was rejected. At Calley's court-martial, he was convicted of premeditated murder of not less than 22 Vietnamese people, sentenced to life in prison. Ultimately, Calley only served 3 years of house arrest and confinement to his barracks.
Can you cite examples of service members who refused to follow illegal orders during the Vietnam and Iraq wars, and explain what happened to them?
Yes, during the Vietnam War, Dr. Howard Levy was a captain in the Army. He was chief of dermatological services, and he disobeyed an order to train Green Berets to be paramedics. He thought they would use their medical training to gain the trust of the Vietnamese people, who would then not oppose the U.S. troops carrying out their illegal missions. Levy called this the prostitution of medicine. He was charged with several crimes, and he tried to argue at his court-martial that the Vietnam War was illegal, that U.S. troops were committing war crimes. He was not allowed to raise that defense. He was convicted of all charges, dismissed from the Army, forfeited all pay and allowances, and sentenced to 3 years confinement at hard labor. Now, during the Iraq War, that's George W. Bush's Iraq War, in 2006, U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watata was the first commissioned officer to publicly disobey an order to deploy to Iraq. The Army charged Watata with missing movement and conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. Watata said the war in Iraq is, in fact, illegal. It is my obligation and my duty to refuse orders to participate in this war. Now, at Watada's court-martial, the military judge refused to allow me to testify as an expert on the illegality of the Iraq War and the war crimes the Bush administration was committing there. The judge eventually declared a mistrial, and Watada was allowed to resign from the army and was discharged under less than honorable conditions. And then another example from the Iraq War was the case of Pablo Paredes. I was allowed to testify as an expert in his 2005 court-martial. He was a U.S. Navy Petty Officer Third Class who refused orders to board an amphibious assault ship that would transport 3,000 Marines to Iraq because he thought he would be complicit as a war criminal. The Navy charged him with unauthorized absence and missing his ship's movement by design. Now, the military judge didn't allow me to testify in the guilt phase, and he convicted Paredes of missing movement by design, but dismissed the unauthorized absence charge. Once again, Paredes told the judge, "I'm guilty of believing this war is illegal. I have a duty to refuse to participate in this war because it is illegal." Now, the judge did allow me to testify at Paredes's sentencing hearing. I testified that the Iraq War violated the UN Charter, that Paredes had a reasonable belief that by transporting Marines to Iraq, he would place them in the position of committing war crimes. And I explained how U.S. forces were torturing prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison, which constituted war crimes. I cited the Nuremberg Principles, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and explained the duty to obey lawful orders, but the duty also to disobey unlawful orders. And then I concluded that Paredes had a duty to refuse those unlawful orders to embark on that ship in December 2004. The government sought 9 months in the brig, forfeiture of pay and allowances, and a bad conduct discharge. But the judge sentenced Paredes to no jail time, refused to order a bad conduct discharge. He gave Paredes 2 months restriction to the base, 3 months of hard labor without confinement, and a reduction in rank to seaman recruit.
Well, coming to the current situation, do you believe that in the last 10 months, the U.S. military has in fact engaged in illegal operations, which members of the military should have refused to participate in?
Yes, the National Guard troops and Marines have been deployed to U.S. cities to enforce domestic law in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. And since September, the U.S. military has carried out 21 known attacks, destroying 22 boats in the Caribbean and Pacific Ocean, which killed at least 83 civilians. Now, if this were an armed conflict, these would constitute war crimes because you are forbidden from targeting civilians. If this were an armed conflict, then these would be war crimes. If it was not an armed conflict, it would be murder. There's no evidence that this group of boat people were committing an armed attack against the U.S. that would allow the U.S. military to use force in national self-defense. So these strikes constitute extrajudicial executions. These, if they are criminal activities, they should be disrupted, investigated, and prosecuted in accordance with the rule of law and due process. It is illegal to deliberately attack civilians, whether there's an armed conflict or not. These strikes on the boats also violate the right to life under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Also, the U.S. has ratified it, making it part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And it outlaws extrajudicial killing outside the context of armed conflict or by law enforcement when necessary to protect against imminent threat to life. And that was not the case here. Now, Steve, on September 2nd, the U.S. military did what's called a double tap. First, they bombed one of these boats, and then they bombed again and killed the survivors of the first attack in violation of the Geneva Conventions. All shipwrecked people must be protected under Geneva, and you can never target civilians. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth either gave the order or should have known that Admiral Bradley would give that order for the second tap, but orders for the entire operation, which, as I said, was illegal, came from Donald Trump. He admitted that it was his operation. He gave the orders. So under the doctrine of command responsibility, everyone, the service members carrying out the attack, all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief, and that would be Donald Trump, are guilty. And service members had a duty to disobey those orders to bomb those boats, not just the one on September 2nd, but all of them, because they were illegal.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Stephen Rohde, for this segment. Today's guest is Marjorie Cohn, an expert on international law. Marjorie, let's turn to the UN Security Council's shameful endorsement of the Trump-Netanyahu plan for Gaza. And you've written about this in Truth Out. Do you believe the plan and the Security Council resolution violate fundamental tenets of international law?
Yes, Steve. They grant control over Gaza to the U.S.-led Board of Peace, so-called, and it orders the deployment of a U.S.-led occupation force called International Stabilization Force, or ISF. Trump himself will oversee both colonial bodies in collaboration with Israel, and Palestinians will not be allowed to participate in their own governance. This so-called Board of Peace will control all services and humanitarian aid, all ingress and egress into and out of Gaza, and it will supervise the financing and reconstruction of Gaza. It does not require the unimpeded provision of humanitarian aid. The ISF will have the power to disarm Palestinian groups at the insistence of Israel, but there's no provision in the resolution for disarming the Israel occupation forces that are committing the genocide. The bottom line is this resolution violates the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination.
Francesca Albanez, the special rapporteur on the Palestinian territories, has called this a brazen attempt to impose by threat of continued force against virtually defenseless populations, U.S. and Israeli interests, plain and simple. Tell us about her position and more about her condemnation of the plan.
Yes, Steve. Well, first, I want to say that the Trump administration has actually imposed sanctions against her for cooperating with the International Criminal Court in its prosecution, its war crimes and crimes against humanity prosecution against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Albanese said that this resolution will leave Palestine in the hands of a puppet administration, assigning the United States, which shares complicity in the genocide, as the new manager of the open-air prison that Israel has already established. And she cited a case of the International Court of Justice, which is the judicial arm of the UN. And she said that decision was clear. Self-determination is an inalienable right of the Palestinian people, and the UN and all states have an obligation to assist in its realization. And then she added, this can only begin with the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of Israel's unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory. Replacing an abusive trustee with another is not self-determination, she said. It is unlawful.
How have the Palestinians reacted to this plan?
Well, Hamas and the other Palestinian factions have rejected this plan and this resolution. They wrote in a joint statement that this ISF will turn into a type of imposed guardianship or administration, reproducing a reality that restricts the Palestinian people's right to self-determination and managing their own affairs. Hamas said, assigning the international force with tasks and roles inside the Gaza Strip, including disarming the resistance, strips it of its neutrality and turns it into a party to the conflict in favor of the occupation. Any international force if established, should only be present at the border to separate the forces and monitor the ceasefire, and it should be under full UN supervision and act solely in coordination with the Palestinian institutions without the occupation having any role in this. And then Steve, Samir al-Bakri, a resident of Gaza City, told Mondo Weiss, "It is as if the mission of the international force coming to Gaza is to protect Israel's borders from Palestinians without offering anything in return to us. And it won't even offer us any real protection either. It won't prevent Israel from carrying out its military operations or aerial bombardments of Gaza. It may even help Israel achieve its goals."
Marjorie, can you give us some insight into why 13 members of the Security Council voted for this resolution?
The only thing I can figure, Steve, is that the United States applied such pressure on these countries and threats and blackmail like they've done in the past, that the countries relented. And even China and Russia abstained. Now, ostensibly, they abstained, didn't exercise their veto power, because some of the Arab countries convinced them to do so.
Is the Security Council the last word, Marjorie? Is there anything that the UN General Assembly can do about this?
Well, the UN Charter grants primary authority for the maintenance of international peace and security to the Security Council. The Uniting for Peace procedure is a mechanism that was created in a resolution adopted by the General Assembly in 1950 to bypass the Soviet Union's veto in the Council during the Korean War. And the Uniting for Peace resolution says that the failure of the Security Council to discharge its responsibilities on behalf of all the member states does not relieve member states of their obligations or the United Nations of its responsibility under the Charter to maintain international peace and security. The General Assembly could act to mitigate the potential harms of Security Council Resolution 2803. If the General Assembly convenes under Uniting for Peace with a two-thirds majority, they could adopt a comprehensive resolution to reaffirm the Palestinian right to self-determination and the illegality of any occupation or colonization of their land. They could adopt measures to hold the Israeli regime accountable, deploy protection for the Palestinian people, and mitigate the worst elements of Resolution 2803. Now, Colombian President Gustavo Petro declared that he will introduce a Uniting for Peace resolution in the General Assembly to establish a multinational protection force for Palestinians and levy sanctions and an arms blockade to end the genocide and liberate Palestine from the unlawful Israeli occupation. In retaliation, I should say, the U.S. government revoked Petro's visa, imposed sanctions against him, raised punitive tariffs on Colombia, and threatened the use of military force against Colombia.
Marjorie, as we come to a close, how can listeners help stop this atrocity and support the struggle of the Palestinian people for self-determination?
Well, Steve, I want to encourage people to join the BDS, or Boycott Divestment Sanctions Movement, which has become mainstream and has had a real economic impact, negative impact on the Israeli economy. People should also lobby for arms embargoes and support accountability for Israeli and U.S. leaders who are responsible for and aiding and abetting the genocide.
Marjorie, thank you so much for what you do, your writing, and your clarity in sharing this kind of information with our listeners and in the way you do it every day. Thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. Most of my articles have been published by Truthout. If you go to the bottom of the homepage and click under Human Rights and Global Wrongs, that's my column, and you can read my pieces there. But all of my pieces and many interviews and videos, etc., are compiled at my website, marjoriecohn.com.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org, and there you'll learn ways to pledge your support for the show, and we appreciate that as well.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.